In the Pattern Podcast. Make left traffic, clear for the option.
Alright, squadron VS bar, proof exchange approved, 4x. Line up and wait, 7 range, 4x.
Mark Tower, 172, Romeo Hotel, hold a short on the 133, ready to take off.
I'll be done about 3-2-1 Mike, and it will be downwind for runway 25.
I'm John.
I'm Chris.
And I'm Mark.
And we are the In the Pattern Podcast.
Hello and welcome to episode 6 of the In the Pattern Podcast. I'm Chris, one of your hosts. Along with me is John in the frigid northeast of Maryland. And we got Mark on the opposite end of the spectrum in California, but he's getting drenched. How you doing, guys?
Hey, how's it going? It's very cold here, though it's supposed to be 50 this weekend, so looking forward to it. Hopefully get some flying in.
50? Incredible compared to what you were getting.
I know. At the end of December, it's just unheard of.
On the opposite end of the spectrum from that is I've been in the 60s and stuff for weeks at a time now. I don't think it's even dropped below 50 except for at night for a little while, you know, but during the day, incredible. We've been getting that rain that, you know, that Mark's been seeing out there in California. It's been drizzling over this way, and we did get some hail the other day that was pretty bad. Talk a little bit more about that later. I got kind of a funny story about that, but and Mark, you haven't your house hadn't slid off the side of a mountain or anything like that, right?
No, I'm lucky. I'm actually down in the foothill, well, not the foothill region, but the valley region, and we're just getting wet, just really wet, and then it'll go away for a couple of days and get wet again. So it kind of puts a dampener on flying, but you know, I try to grab a clear day once in a while. So, but it's good. It gives me a chance to study for the written. So
there you go. Yeah. If you can't be up flying, you got to be reading about all the rules and regulations so we can pass that test.
Doing
you
the homework.
You have no idea. You have no idea.
I'm so far behind you guys on that part. It's not even funny. John's just been, you've been up in the air, what, about three times a week or something?
Pretty close to that, actually. I've been just busting through it.
Nice.
We'll get into everything I've done in a little bit, but man, it's been great.
It's a way to stay proficient.
Definitely.
Yeah. So where should we start? This will be the first podcast I actually have something relevant and current to say about recent flying, because up until now, I haven't had a podcast to speak of, I don't think, that I've actually been behind the yoke, right? Is that right?
It's been a couple for you. Been a few.
Actually, no, I don't think you've flown since we started the podcast.
That's second wrong.
Because I thought about it, and the first podcast, you did have some things to say, because I believe you flew that week, but that was it.
Wow.
And we've been hampered by not being able to get together and talk, so that throws a few more weeks in there, too.
Wow.
Wow. I'm sorry, I've been training too much to talk.
Yeah.
I'll rub it in a little.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, I'll go back to December 9th. December 9th, my first flight back since 4Mike Alpha got put back together and it's been available to use to me. They had it back together. I went over this and they were flying it, but because the engine was completely taken apart and put back together, and they put the run-in oil. What's the oil that they use?
It's straight mineral oil.
Mineral oil, right. When they use the mineral oil for the break-in period, like they do through an overhaul or whatever, they have to have 10 solid hours of flight time on it, not back-to-back-to-back, but, I mean, like they want at least 10 one-hour, you know, at altitude, at, 75% power or whatever, as much as they can all at once. So they wouldn't allow us to use it for touch and goes, which would be on the throttle, off the throttle, on the throttle, off the throttle, and so on. So December 9th, the first day back, which was 2 months minus 1 day to the day of the last time I flew it. It was October. October 10th was my previous flight to that. So it had been a while. So, and it was quite strange. I mean, going over the checklist, for example, took me so much longer than what I'd gotten used to doing. You know, I was really having to read through and double and triple check everything as I was going down the list. Whereas before, I'd finally gotten, you know, somewhat familiar with it to where I had it almost memorized. So, but the flying part of it, not so bad. My landings, not as great as they were previous to that. And so previous to that, my instructor had said, okay, you know, your next flight and then the one after that, I'll solo you. I was like, cool, you know, as long as everything stays consistent. So in my mind, two flights and I'd be soloing. Well, it kept taking longer and longer before we got back out there. And so finally, you know, it was like, well, we ain't going to be able to do it, obviously, in two flights. And it took a little bit more than that. And since then, well, I end up flying on December 9th. I flew again December 10th. And I think I flew on the 12th and like maybe the 14th or something. Anyways, I flew four days out of six to kind of get current again. And I tell you, it's a lot of fun getting back up there and doing it again. Radio calls were fine. The flying was fun. Like I said, the landings weren't all that great. We got them sorted out again. But what did kind of tick me off there a little bit was December 10th. December 10th, I got caught behind a Piper Seminole 747. I say that because the jackass thinks he's flying one of the TransPAC students. The air traffic controllers are just letting them fly wherever, whenever, and they're just, you know, it's not that big of airplane. And I'm complaining about his pattern size. For example, I'm just taking off after a touch and go, and the controller tells me, Archer 4 Mike Alpha, continue following the Seminole, turning crosswind over top of the 101 and 51. Now, I just took off. I'm ready to turn crosswind right now. This guy is literally 7 miles in front of me, and they want me to keep following him and wait for him to pass me, of course, till I can turn. And that happened just pretty much all day. Basically, we called it a day after I'd only got in three landings after 8/10 of an hour. It was ridiculous. Normal for me, I can get in between 7 and 8 landings in 1 hour. So I'd only gotten in three landings, including the full stop landing, in 8/10. So it really pissed me off. Have you guys ran into anything like that?
Never. Except maybe for the Warthogs that kind of sent me in some 360s a couple times.
Yeah.
But it was just a couple of those that came in and they were just doing a straight in landing and that was it.
Yeah. And Mark, you're at a uncontrolled field that so you don't have a whole lot of traffic to deal with, right?
Yeah, unless it's a really nice day and then it's all just GA aircraft. So I haven't run into that. I know it's coming. We've got a couple of controlled airspaces that we go and do our training at night and there's a lot of heavy traffic there. So I know it's coming. So I'll feel your pain here pretty soon.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, this guy is just driving me nuts in the Seminole and in the back of my head, I'm like going, can I just call the controller and say, you know, tower, is it okay if I go ahead and turn crosswind now? He's 7 miles ahead of me. I'll be so far in front of him, you know. He's a twin. He's going to, I guess, end up catching up to me or something. I don't know. But it wasn't – I just thought it would be cool if they let me jump in front of him, you know, and just get my work done. But having me just burn gas for no – you know, to follow that guy was just driving me nuts.
You know, I bet if you make a call to them, they would probably sympathize with you, say, look, you know, I don't need to fly 747 patterns.
Mm-hmm. And then on his way back, he's coming in at an angle. He's not even – he has no idea what a rectangle even is. So then he's on downwind, right? He passes me on downwind, and then I make my crosswind turn, and I start following him. And so he's on downwind. Now he's – past the airport. I normally turn right at I-17. I'm over top of the 101 on downwind, and then I turn on I-17 for crosswind, or I mean for base. And then it's real short to final. But this guy is now so far down. He's now in Glendale, in almost Glendale, Glendale's airspace. He was in Scottsdale's airspace almost when they said he was over top of the 101 and the 51. That's almost Scottsdale airspace. And then he turns again and he's almost at Glendale airspace. So it's just really just real frustrating because in my mind, I just need to get some touch and goes down so I can solo, you know. So here's 8/10 of an hour that I pay for. I get 3 lousy landings in, and it was pretty much a wasted day. So then I go back out the next day, and it was a lot better. I logged 1.3 hours. This was on my third trip out. My first trip out after the 2 months, I did 1.2 hours, and I had 6 touch and goes and one full stop landing, and that was a pretty good day. So it was that second day was pretty much a disaster. The third day was much better. Like I said, I logged 1.3 hours, and I had 6 touch and goes, 1 go around, and 1 full stop landing. And it was better and worse at the same time. You know, I had one of those controllers that didn't quite, I don't know, have us all figured out where we were in the pattern at some point. He actually cleared me to land just after he cleared somebody to take off on the same runway. On final, and a guy pulls out onto the runway and he's supposed to be going. So I said, Tower, we're going to do a go around since you just, you know, put that airplane in my way, because, you know, if his engine stops or something, you know, we're in a bad situation there. So I peel off and do a go around, but those are good to do too, right? You know, you got to practice those too. So
absolutely.
Now I have a question with that. Did he tell the guy to expedite it?
I don't know. I'll have to go back and check the tape.
And on top of that, did you go to either side of the runway so as he's taking off you?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I gave it the gas. I went to the right hand side of the runway and then performed a crosswind I turned crosswind at like midfield and got back into the pattern.
Just curious.
It was you know, if everything was perfect every time, then you wouldn't really maybe know what to do in situations like that, so you got to run into that once in a while to feel okay when it does come up again, I guess. So those aren't so bad after all. Still after that day, so that was my third day of flying. Hopefully, I was hoping that was going to be the day I soloed, but because that day before was a waste, you know, I didn't. So still after that one day, she still wanted me to do one more day before soloing. And honestly, I was a little pissed off. I really thought we did a great job that day, and the landings were real good. I had several landings out of those seven landings, several of them, I was on the mains so light that the wheels didn't chirp.
Nice.
Have you had some of those to where they just skid a little bit and roll? Not even a chirp. That was just, and I was holding the front wheel off, cruising down the runway with my nose high, you know, like those soft field landings, you know. I was like, yeah, had it down. It was feeling good, you know, and gas it and go. But she wanted one more before that, so you
know.
Doesn't
that just feel good?
Yeah, I like those.
When you do that, mm-hmm. I love it.
Just like butter. So, anyway, so that's a little catch up to where I've got to. More to come on that, but who wants to go next to catch us up? What you've been doing?
Well, let me knock mine out real quick because I know that John's got a ton more than me. So. So since our last podcast, I just looked at my logbook and I've got 3 flights, and unfortunately in the remarks it only says which Jeppesen lesson it is because we use the Jeppesen syllabus. So I broke that out and we did the beginning stuff of VOR, ADF, power on and power off stalls, practiced all that stuff again, make sure that I can pretty much do it with my eyes closed, which the third lesson I actually did. I had to do all that stuff under the hood, so which was cool. I've always been a little bit intimidated with the VORs, not quite understanding the to and the from and everything. And my instructor goes, flush all that stuff out of your head. He gave me this website to go look at, which I highly recommend to anybody. It's a great simulator. It is – let me pull the notes up. Luismontero.com. That's LuisMonteiro.com. It's a VOR simulator. And you could actually just Google VOR simulator and it'll pull it up. It made learning VOR so easy. And there's all kinds of other stuff that you can do with that simulator too. But
I've been on that site before.
Man,
yeah, it, nice. I highly recommend it. Good stuff.
It made everything click, and it was so clear. I was like, I got this. So when I went out for my next flight, I did some VOR work under the hood, and my instructor is like, okay, get us on this radial, and okay, great. Now get me on a two from, you know, the SAC VOR, which is a Sacramento Executive VOR, and he goes, I want to be on this radial. Get me there. Under the hood, boom, right there. And I was like, I got this. He's like, wow, I've never seen anybody pick this up as fast as you have. And I said, you know what, that VOR sim, it all just clicked for me. So if you're having problems out there, jump on that website, Google VOR simulator. I highly, highly recommend it. Let's see. Did more stuff, more radio comm. I'm really comfortable on the radio now, so that's not a big issue anymore. No more stage fright on the mic. Started working on some more short field and soft field takeoff and landing. I need to work on my technique. It's just a little bit of finesse that I'm kind of missing a little bit. I also had my daughter, my older daughter, was in the back seat. It should have made it easier to stay on the mains, keep the nose up, but for whatever reason, it didn't. So my next lesson that I have to go fly is a solo, and I have clearance to practice this stuff by myself. So I think that's what I'm going to work on, is just pattern stuff. Then the following – my next dual lesson, which I'm actually really kind of excited about, and I'd like to do it the next week or so while the Christmas lights are up, is my first night flight. So –
I'm kind of enjoy it.
Yeah, I've because the nights here in the winter are just so clear. I mean, even if there's some cloud cover around, it's just so clear that I'm excited about trying that out. Then after that, I have to do the written, and then we do dual day and night cross countries. So that's the point where I'm at right now. So just need to work on a little bit of finessing and on the soft and shorts, and then get ready for the written. So, and I've been studying my tail off. My flight school, my instructor wants me to bring in – I've been using the Sporty's Study Buddy. He wants me to print out three test scores of 80% or higher before he'll endorse me to go take the test. And just using the one on my phone, on my iPhone I'm in the 85s anyway. So during this, doing the study buddy, I haven't had a chance to go through one complete one yet, but due to the holidays. But I think I'm pretty much ready to go for that. So, but that's all I've been doing, and I'm progressing pretty happily. So I'd like to do more than once a week, but that's the point that I'm at right now. Especially when the weather's good, the plane gets. The Archer that I fly gets booked up pretty quick, so you got to be quick on the scheduling website. But anyway,
it's all done online.
Yeah, we use a website called schedulepoint.com, and from what I understand, there's a lot of schools that use that. So when you log in, it takes you directly to your school, so you don't see anybody else's stuff, and it shows you all the aircraft that are available, all your instructor schedule, and it's almost like an Excel spreadsheet. And you just pick the time that you want to go in, you schedule it, and you pick your instructor, and it fills in the two-hour block that you need, and he gets an email, you get an email, and off you go.
Cool.
But that's where I'm at. So I'm right at about 20 hours right now. So – according to the Jeppesen lessons, I'm like three quarters of the way through the lessons. So all of the work that we do now is going to start to make up the other 20 plus hours that I'm going to need before I can, I have minimums to go do a check ride. So.
Excellent. Excellent. The nighttime stuff sounds like a lot of fun.
And I can't wait.
Yeah.
I can't wait.
Checking out the all the lights, Christmas lights from up there should be pretty cool.
There's no time to look at lights.
You know what? I was kind of thinking that too. I'm just going to see the city lights and I'm going to be like, crap, where am I? But, you know, it's all relative. I'm going to be flying at night. What do I care, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
All right, John, where you been? What have you been doing?
Okay, I don't have my logbook in front of me. This is going to be hard. So, what have I been doing? Everything. Absolutely everything. I've been studying for the written. I've been studying for the check ride. I've been doing cross countries. I've been doing night cross countries. I've been doing some solo work. You name it, I've done it.
I saw the one Motion X trace that you did on one of your cross countries. That was pretty impressive.
Which one did I post? That was the night one.
Yeah. Oh yeah. When you went down. I don't know what the exact location was, but it was like 120 something miles each way. I was like, man, you went out.
Yeah. It was a little, probably. Yeah. That's probably about right. That was the night cross country I did, and
that was expensive.
I don't really, you know, honestly, now that I'm doing this pilot finance thing, I don't really realize how much these flights are. I don't look. I'll pay it back later. Actually, I've already started the payments, but
that's probably a good thing that you're not paying attention.
Mm-hmm. Well, I did pay attention to one of the cross countries, and I was like $600. Oh my gosh! But that was actually had 2.5 hours of ground time in addition to the ground time before the flight. So, it was kind of mixed in together with some stuff. But all right, let me start at the beginning here. Last time, I believe I was on a hiatus from flying due to money, personal reasons, all that kind of stuff. The usual for people trying to get their private pilot. And I think right after we recorded that, I got back. I think I went out. First lesson back, I went out and did some maneuvers again. You know, my instructor just wanted to make sure, see how rusty I was and kind of check me out and get me back into it a little bit. Let's see. We did that lesson. That went pretty well. I actually, in the pattern, did a lot better than I expected to. I'm trying to think about what the lesson was after that. We did the maneuver lesson. He actually pulled my engine out over, small little airport, and I got the lab. It was actually the first other airport I've landed that wasn't my airport, that was my primary training airport. Pulled my engine at 3,000 feet and was like, yeah, I think there's an airport there. And I landed on it a little high, a little fast, but better than being low and slow, I guess.
So did you just circle to lose altitude or?
Yeah, I kind of circled and then entered the pattern. And I was high. Actually, I wasn't technically in the pattern because I was high. So I went out, you know, a little bit further because I knew I was high, and I came in high and then just dumped the flaps and just started descending like crazy. Landed halfway down the runway, but, you know, it was pretty good considering. So, especially after my previous issues with emergency landings, I was a little more confident after that one. And then the next lesson I had was actually a solo. I went in and it was right before sunset. I think I landed right at sunset, a couple minutes before. And I did 0.6 in the pattern, got 4 landings, which was nice. That was my second solo. You know, I'm just, I guess it wasn't as exciting because I'd already done it once. It was, interesting being at, you know, it was starting to get dark and it was a little cloudy. So it was a little darker than it would normally be right before sunset. So it was kind of, it's kind of neat. I had to have some of the cabin lights on to be able to see everything really well. And, you know, the airport lights got turned on, the beacon and all that kind of stuff. So it was, well, I guess a little preview of the night flight that was going to be coming up. Then I did a ground lesson, kind of started learning. We actually spent 4 hours going over weather, airspace. He was kind of just making, seeing where I was on my ground training and, you know, all the information I knew. And then we went into cross-country planning. We started planning a cross-country to Cambridge, Charlie Golf Echo, which is in the eastern shore of Maryland, right south of the Bay Bridge, a little ways. And that's about a 35-minute flight with no wind. So we planned for that, and then we went ahead and did it on the 14th. And that was interesting because, you know, it's your first cross-country flight. You're not quite sure what to expect, but you kind of know what to expect because you've done all the planning. You know, he gave me the sheet that the school uses, and, you know, we went over, here's how to plan. Here's what you're looking for on the chart. Then, you know, here's the headings, the true headings you want to fly. Here's the distance. You know, here's how to measure the distances on the chart. And we kind of went over all the basics of that and put it all down on the chart. You know, I figured out the wind correction angles and what the magnetic heading would actually end up being, and then the ground speed and then the time and the fuel burn and all that kind of stuff. So we did all that. I had my little sheet ready to go. We went in and took off for Cambridge, and I immediately didn't start checking my DG, which was horribly off. So I was a good 5 or 6 degrees off what I should have been flying. Mm. Something that still kind of catches me every once in a while. I've been a lot better at checking it, just not as good at checking it immediately after takeoff. So kind of once you get up there and you're kind of settled and you're ready to start, you know, your first course, yeah, you need to just check it and set it. And that's kind of been getting me a couple times. But so we went down to Cambridge. It was really, really windy. I think we had, you know, 30 knot winds up there. It was bumpy as hell. Mm. Somewhat low clouds. We wanted to fly at 3,500, being that we were flying between 0 and 179 degrees. So odd thousands plus 500. And we weren't able to because there was probably a good cloud layer at about 3,000. So we stayed down at about 2, which proved to be useful because I got to transition Easton's Class Delta, which was a good kind of a good thing to have, you know, kind of get used to being able to, you know, enter other people's airspace that you're not intending to land at.
What was the distance of the flight one way?
Oh, it's 50, I want to say 50 some miles.
Yeah.
About, I don't know the exact number off the top of my head, but it's not terribly far. Then, you know, there's a couple small checkpoints. Each leg was about 3 to 5 minutes, 6 max, depending on the wind. Cause we had a pretty strong headwind on the way back. So it was a couple times it was about 6 minutes or so, but, it was a little, I don't know, that flight was a little frustrating in that you're kind of thrown into having to know all the stuff. Like, you know, the airports and the different airspaces you're coming up on come up a lot faster than I expected them to. So it was hard to stay ahead of the airplane and have all of the frequencies you wanted in at the times you wanted them in and you know, to remember to check your time and reset your time at each leg, you know. So I'd get to a leg and I'd be like, all right, now I need to go here. I need to set this heading. And then I'd forgot to, you know, reset my time. Because using pilotage and dead reckoning, you know, you need to check your time and then you need to verify your time was fairly close. So there was just a lot of stuff going on in that cockpit. And I can tell you right now, for the first 15 minutes and even still to now, I'm still having trouble figuring out where to put things, how to organize it. CRM, cockpit resource management, is just—it's difficult at first, because you know you're kind of just end up in the situation. You're like, oh, I need to have that out, but it's down there. I didn't think of that, and then you're trying to fiddle with stuff, and then you're dropping your pencil on the floor, and then you're like, but I need to get it. But then you get it, and then you know you're accidentally full right rudder. And, you know, it just gets it gets to be interesting. So that was an interesting flight. We made it fine. He actually did the landing at Cambridge, partially. He kind of helped me on it because it was we turned base and just got this tremendous gust of wind. So we were fighting that one to the ground.
A crosswind?
Yeah, mm-hmm. It was a pretty good crosswind too. And so he kind of helped me a little bit on that landing, and then. You know, we stopped, went in. A really nice restaurant there, actually. I really want to eat there. It's a nice new building. Another weird thing was being at another airport. You know, you stop and you're like, I'm in Cambridge. It takes 2.5 hours to get here by car.
Oh, yeah.
And I'm like, I just flew here in 30 minutes. And
think of the possibilities, right?
Yeah, you start really getting it when you start doing cross countries and you finally went somewhere and yet it wasn't as grand a thing, I guess, because it was just such a tremendous amount of thought and stuff going on. You didn't really get to enjoy it too much. I was constantly trying to catch up to the airplane and that kind of stuff, which is never what you want to do. But you know, we stopped. We talked about what happened. We, you know, got back in the airplane and went home. The home trip was a lot better because I had done a trip now. I had kind of gotten thrown into it and then said, okay, now I know what to expect. And you start kind of thinking now, okay, maybe I'll make this change and I'll do this differently. And so the way back was a lot better. That ended up being almost a 2-hour flight. It was 1.9 hours just because it was so windy. It took us like 25 minutes to get down there. It took us like 45, 50 to get back. And then all your ground time and all that, because we spent a lot of time on the ground, just kind of going over everything, making sure everything was right. And so that was my first cross country. And much to my surprise, when we got back, he signed me off to do my solo, or basically said, the next time you go, you're going to go there solo.
Cross country solo now.
Cross country solo. So short cross country solo, but I may not have thought that I was ready at that point, but I guess I demonstrated enough to prove I was, and you know, I made it. I'm still alive. But
obviously you didn't scare the hell out of him.
Yeah.
Yeah, I didn't. And I think a lot of it was that part of the thing on that flight was I was fighting the plane so much because of the wind. So on top of
the wind was to your back going there, obviously, and then you had that nasty headwind coming home.
Yeah.
And maybe you had a little crosswind with that quartering crosswind or something like that pushing you in also to the side.
Yeah. It was there was just – and it was bumpy as hell. I mean, we were all over the place. Like you'd be flying somewhere. You'd look down. You'd be perfect on everything, and then you'd look up. Look around for traffic, look back down, you're 100 feet lower. And you're like, how the hell did that happen?
Oh, yeah. Huh.
And, I mean, we were just getting thrown around. You know, you're constantly fighting the plane. And
Are you constantly trimming it out or something, trying to work with that?
No, I didn't. I trimmed it to where I thought it should be, and I left it.
Yeah.
At that point, I was fighting the wind blowing the plane, and I was bringing it back to being stable a little quicker, you know, and just making sure it didn't do anything too drastic. So I was constantly fighting headings and altitudes, and there was a lot of just fighting the plane and trying to learn cross countries and pilotage and dead reckoning at the same time. It was a lot of work, but I think the fact that I handled it okay in the wind that we had made him a little more comfortable. I hope so. He signed me off, and the next time it was a much, much calmer day. Very high clouds. Maybe 5,000 or so, overcast. So plenty of room for me to fly at 3,500. And actually, I didn't come near any clouds at that time.
So was your time down there longer that time because you didn't have a tailwind, and time back more the same in line with your to time versus your from time?
Yeah, it ended up being a little closer to 30 some minutes each way instead of like 25 and like 45.
Mm-hmm.
So it was a much calmer day. There was, I think the winds aloft were like 17 knots. It was not anything at all. I mean, the winds on the ground were maybe 10, and it was like a direct headwind. So it was a nice day. And so he sent me off. You know, I went out to the plane, pre-flighted it, got in, started it up, and I started doing all my checks. And then I checked everything again. Then I taxied, and, you know, I went. I did a really long run-up because I sat there, I did the run-up, and then I started, you know, fiddling with where to put things in the cockpit and trying to figure out where I wanted things to be. And I spent a little bit of time just making sure I had everything where I wanted it. And I had briefed myself one more time about where I was going, what headings I was flying, how I was going to go about doing it, what I needed for right after takeoff. And then after takeoff, once everything's good, what I needed to do after that. And then I, you know, after taking some time, prepped myself, I took off and started on my way. This time, remembering my checklists, which before when I was in the air, the cruise checklist, the descent checklist, the after takeoff checklist, I'd kind of forgotten to do those. It was overwhelming for the first cross country. So this time I got to do them all. And down there, I ended up a little west of my intended course. I ended up a little west of Easton Airport, which I flew over. You know, but I never got lost. I knew where I was. You know, I saw what happened. The winds aloft weren't quite what I thought they would be. So when I got to Cambridge, I actually recalculated them and had a much better flight on the way back. I was like right on the money on the way back. But I guess the notes on that cross country, the biggest thing was the first time I got flight following. Let's see, right before I took off, he was like, okay, when you get up there, he's like, call Potomac. Here's what you say. You know, get flight following. Make sure you have flight following. Said it like 20 billion times. So, you know, I get up there, I get established, I get across, I get out of Martin's airspace, you know, and I call up and I get flight following. It was beneficial because immediately I had traffic, you know, coming up. Actually, not far from me, almost at the same altitude, but we're kind of traveling opposite directions. So he was off to the west, traveling north. I was traveling south. You know, so I got a visual on him and everything was good. But it was weird talking to people when you're not, I guess, around the airport.
Oh, uh-huh.
And then the thing, too, is that we leave Potomac's airspace. So I actually got transferred to Patuxent. So I got the handoff, too. You know, where he's like, all right, you're done. Call Patuxent if you want more flight following. So I called Patuxent and I was like, all right, I'm here with you. I'm, you know, so far away from Cambridge. And that was a good experience. And I feel a little better talking on the radio too, after having, you know, talked to the approach controllers and all that kind of stuff some more. So that was my first small cross country solo.
And they were cool with you and didn't, not blow you off or anything like that. I was able to give you the flight following.
Yeah, they were able to get me the flight following. There wasn't too many people there. You know, a couple of other VFR flights that I think were on flight following as well, but not much. A few Southwest airlines. You know, Southwest heavy, they kept saying.
They're a little higher than you, though.
Just a little.
Yeah.
But, yeah, that was a good experience. I knew the value of it, but it was good to see it, you know, in practice, and to experience it in practice because, you know, I didn't quite know what to expect there. Let's see. After my solo, we went ahead and did the night cross country. So this was interesting. Number one, my flashlight died that morning. Turns out one of the batteries had exploded.
Oh, no.
Oh.
Inside the flashlight?
Yeah, I couldn't get it out.
Really, it was just wedged in there then?
It was just wedged in there. So
I had that happen on a mag light.
It was a mag light too. And
recall.
Yeah. So I get to the flight school and he's like, you got a flashlight? I'm like, I did. Like, I'm sorry, I had it. And I took it to work to change the batteries because I couldn't get the back open. So I was going to do it the night before, but I couldn't get it open. And I'm like, I don't have any pliers here, but there's pliers at work. So I was like, I'll just do it at work tomorrow. So I went to work and pulled it open and I was like, oh, crap.
And now you know why it was so hard to get the back open, huh?
Yeah, I know. So we ended up having a flashlight. It was just barely worked. I mean, it worked, but if you moved it the wrong way, it would shut off, and it was, like, hard to get it back to. So
So I guess that takes care of the problem of you pulling out a flashlight. Okay, that one's dead. Pulling another one out, that one's dead. Pulling that one out, that one's dead. Have you heard that story of the instructor?
Yes, I have. And
yeah,
I didn't have that problem.
it's dead for real. Sorry.
Needless to say, I do have actually two flashlights now, thanks to Santa Claus.
Awesome.
Yes, and one of them has the little red light LEDs and the white light LEDs, so it's perfect. I'm excited because I'm going on a night flight tomorrow. But
cool.
So we go up, and he talks about, okay, we're going to plan the flight. So I planned a flight to Ocean City, Maryland, which is about 85 miles straight distance. We plan the flight, and it's interesting because at night flight, you're using airports and cities. So those little yellow spots on the sectional, those are really helpful because it's clear those are cities. Those are big areas of light. And I was amazed at how accurate that was, because there's two points of light that I used on the two cities. I forget the one in Milford. There's two towns there. And it was so clear when you're flying over that those were the two towns you were looking for. It just surprised me, I guess. The other thing with that flight, you use an airport. So, we got to do the, okay, tune in on the lights, click it a couple times, and all of a sudden there's a Bray airport in front of you. I got a lot of, yeah, I got a lot of practice looking for the beacon. Because that's really all you can see from far away. The runway looks like any other light on the ground. You can't differentiate it from 10, 20 miles out. So, I get a lot of good practice looking for the beacon. And then once you find the beacon, you're flying in the right way. And you just kind of follow that and then move on to the next checkpoint. It was a little interesting trying to be able to see everything. I used him a lot to kind of hold the flashlight and point it where I needed it a couple times. Like the gauges, most of them lit up. Actually, a couple of them were out, which also proved to be a little difficult. The airspeed indicator, I think, was out, but it was clearly visible. There wasn't any issue with that, but the turn coordinator was also out, so it was kind of hard to see the ball occasionally. And then the compass was as well. So every time I wanted to check the DG to the compass, I had to have him shine the light up there. or the kneeboard. I couldn't see the kneeboard, and the chart was kind of hard to see. So I needed him to shine it on there when I wanted to get my time. So that actually proved to be pretty difficult. I learned real quick while people like Denver Pilot wear headlamps. I can see the use in them now and why. Because before I'm thinking, well, everything should be lit up kind of. All the gauges are lit up. Why would you need a headlamp for that? But when you want to see stuff in your lab, when lights are out, it's so useful to have. So I think that's going on my birthday list. So, but other than that, we went down to Ocean City, turned around, came back, got to use the autopilot and, learn the GPS on the way back. Another windy day took us 30 minutes to get down there. It should have been 50, or it took us about an hour and 20 to get back.
Oh.
It took forever.
Brutal.
So that was, it was definitely neat though, seeing all the lights. The one thing that occurred to me, and he actually brought it up later, was what if your engine fails?
Yeah, at night? That would completely suck.
Yeah, I'm sorry, you're screwed.
A lot. That would suck a lot.
I can't see what's a field and what's not. I can't see anything.
Yeah, I think I'd have to go for a road with the streetlights on each side of it, hopefully.
Well, if they're streetlights.
Yeah.
Because half the time, the only way I could see a road is if there's cars on it.
Mm-hmm.
And that kind of makes it a little more, when landing. So, that's something where it's just I can see why flying at night, you might want to think twice a couple times. It was neat, but at the same time, I can see the differences there. One of the other problems we found was we were looking out, and my instructor started getting worried. He's like, what is that out there? He's like, is that a low cloud? And we actually kind of diverted from our original course and started going south instead of continuing east because we thought it was a low cloud. that we were going to head straight into. Turns out it was just the Delaware Bay.
Oh.
The water on the horizon created this illusion of a low cloud. And it was really weird. The other weird thing was when you got to Ocean City, it's on the Atlantic Ocean. So you have, you know, the ground, you have all these lights, and then you have this black hole.
That's exactly what I was going to ask you. I was going to let you finish your thought, but I was like, you I'm looking at your route kind of on Google Earth right now, and I'm like, you fly over some pretty good bodies of water. And I was going to ask you, what was that like to fly over lights, then black, and then lights, and then you go out to the Atlantic Ocean where it's really black?
Yeah, it was a little disorienting, and actually kind of disorienting for my instructor as well.
If you had clouds above too, blocking any kind of moonlight, it would just make it worse.
Yeah, and luckily this was actually the night of the
eclipse.
Yeah, so it was a full moon.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a clear night. There were no clouds, but it's just like the bay, the actual Chesapeake Bay wasn't bad. It's fairly short. It's maybe 5 miles, 10 miles, or something. Not a very large body of water when you're flying over it. You know, you could see each side, which was okay. But the Atlantic Ocean, there's no other side.
It's just
nothing. You know, you can't see anything over there. It was really weird. I don't know. It was almost scary.
Yeah, a little eerie feeling that this just goes on for, like, ever now.
Yeah, so... I'm trying to think if there's anything else for the night flight. You know, I got to learn the autopilot, which was cool. The GPS, it was just different. Now I know a little better about night flying, you know, the need for flashlight, the need for, you know, what to expect, now what to look for, things like, you know, bodies of water looking like clouds. There's obviously a lot of illusions. So got a lot of good experience out of it. And that actually ended up being a 2.3 hours. Cause it took so damn long to get back. So then the last flight I did was my long dual cross country. So we went from Martin State to Millville, New Jersey to Cape May, New Jersey, which is south of Atlantic City, maybe 20 miles or so. And on the way out there, I got caught a couple times. I didn't have the traffic pattern altitudes, though I had tabbed the AFD so I could look it up fairly quickly, but it wasn't on my sheet. When I got to Millville, I was like, oh, that must be runway. I forget what it was, 3-2 or something. So we get there, we enter downwind. It was not runway 3-2. I had gotten in the downwind of the wrong one way. Luckily there was no one in the pattern. My instructor kind of let me do it and see why. and he's like, yeah, so, next time, no matter what, overfly the field at 5,000 feet above the field, check the runway orientation, and then, you know, enter the traffic pattern. So good lesson there. I've been having a little trouble visualizing the entrance into the traffic pattern. So I kind of knew what runway to expect, but I hadn't thought about how to enter the pattern based on the winds, based on where I'm coming from. So it was a little hard to kind of think of that on the fly. And then kind of visualize how far to go out, how far to come around, when to enter. So, you know, I'm still kind of having some trouble with that. And same thing, we landed there and then we went to Cape May, and at Cape May, I was having some trouble kind of figuring out, okay, where should I go to enter the traffic pattern? That time I did overfly the field, however, and did an okay crosswind landing. I also got to play with some VORs on that. There's a VOR directly on the course out there. So, you know, I got some experience with using the VOR and tracking that in.
Up until that point, you didn't use a VOR on any of the daytime one, right?
No, I had not used a VOR yet. I understood the concept. I'd actually studied it a bunch before, so I knew what to expect. I knew how it worked.
Mm-hmm.
But I hadn't actually used one in physically myself in a plane. We tracked one with a friend of mine when I went on a flight with him, me back in the spring, but that was kind of the only time I'd ever seen it done in real life. So, got some good experience there. The kind of interesting thing on that flight, however, on the way back, So we're flying north of Dover Air Force Base. And we see this giant freaking jet taking off at Dover. And he's heading up to our altitude and kind of right into our flight path. So my instructor gets on the radio, and we're high flight following from Dover approach at this point. And he's like, hey, we got traffic at 10 o'clock. It looks like a big jet climbing out of Dover. You know, traffic controller comes on. He's like, yeah, he's going to level off at 3,000 and turn east. You know, not going to be a factor. We're flying at 4,500 at this point because we're going west at this time. So after he says that, we realize the 747 is going to fly directly under us. So we both immediately were like, picture, got to get pictures. So we're both reaching for our phones and our pockets and taking pictures of the 747 freaking flying below us.
Was it a 747 or was it a C-5?
It was a 747.
The
controller actually told us, he's like, yeah, it's a 747. It ended up being a cargo plane, but that was the coolest thing.
So how close were you to it overall then, you think?
He was probably about a mile off of us laterally.
Uh-huh.
And he was 1,500 feet below us. And he kind of went in front of us and then off our right side. And then as soon as he passed us, he started climbing out.
Cool.
So we just saw him go right below us. That was neat. The other interesting thing is at the same time, you know, we're listening to Dover Approach for flight following. There's this guy with an accent on there, and he's like, yeah, so Dover Approach, where's the nearest airport? And they're like, well, Georgetown's about 10 miles or whatever. And I don't actually remember what the conversation was from there. But about a minute later, the guy's like, mayday, mayday, mayday.
Hmm. Wow. Where was he?
He was pretty far south of us, not far from this one airport. And it sounded like I got to listen to the audio again. But it sounded like he had a fuel emergency. He was low on fuel and he kept flying. He didn't land at Georgetown, which is the closest airport. He kept flying to Dover, which I believe is a good like 20 miles. Why he did that, I have no idea. But the entire time we're just listening to the guy. He's freaking out on the radio. You know, he's asking all these questions to the controller. And obviously the controller's giving him full attention at that point. You know, letting him, vectoring him into Dover. And he ended up landing okay. Because when they switched to tower, we put the tower in our COM-2 and started monitoring that and listening in. Just to see if he get on the ground. My instructor's like, dude, when he gets on the ground, if he makes it, he is going to be in huge freaking trouble. Because, I mean, he kept flying. Like, I don't know why he didn't land right away. I mean, if you're declaring an emergency, why would you fly further than you have to?
Yeah, if he said mayday, 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 you know, he better be saying that because he's really got an issue.
Yeah, well, they stopped him on the runway at Dover, so I don't know. And he changed runways at Dover, too. So they stopped him on the ground. I don't know what happened to him, but my instructor was basically like, yeah, you're taping this, right? Go listen to it and don't do what he did.
Yeah.
So I get a lot of experience on that trip. But anyway, I got back from that. It was about a 2.7-hour flight. I was a little – when we got back, I was kind of a little – I don't know – down about the flight because I had done a lot. I had been behind the plane a lot. As far as the traffic pattern, the different airports, I guess it was a lot getting used to landing at other airports. And kind of getting used to entering the traffic pattern. Both airports had multiple runways, which was also weird.
Parallel or crossing runways or
crossing.
Oh, that could make it very confusing, I suppose.
Yeah. So, needless to say, I was a little worried about that. But again, I got the endorsement to do my long solo cross country. He basically signed me off and he said, all right, you know, I'll add the date in when the time comes, you know, finish the endorsement. you know, if the weather's good and all that kind of stuff. So right now I'm looking to plan that. So I, within the next week, I'll have done my long solo cross country.
What constitutes a long solo cross country or a long cross country? How many miles is that? Because a regular cross country has to be 50.1 or greater.
It's the same.
So why do they designate longer after it?
Well, the long cross country has to be to an airport greater than 50 nautical miles away, with a total distance of at least 100 miles. And you have to land at 3 airports.
Oh, okay. Maybe that's or, it. Maybe it's a three airports thing.
It's a three
airports. It makes a difference.
And it's 50.1, I do believe. And the reason I say that is because my instructor, we were talking about this, and there used to be an airport that was exactly, because they measure it from center of airport to center of airport, I believe. There was an airport, Payson, Arizona. I don't know if you've heard of it. Mark, you might have.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Payson, Arizona is exactly 50 miles from Deer Valley, and we can no longer use it as a cross country because it's supposed to be 50.1 now.
Yes,
that's weak.
Ain't that some BS?
They made the distinction that it has to be greater than 50, and by that they mean 50.1 or greater.
Mm-hmm.
I believe the rule says 50 nautical miles or greater instead of 50.
No, I think it says greater than 50.
Yes,
like,
what it
like
says.
You said.
Greater than 50.
Yeah.
Instead of greater than or equal to 50.
Mm-hmm.
It's too bad you can't argue 50.01.
Yeah, I said, what if I do one lap around the pattern? I'm sure that's more than a mile. That's more than 0.1. Jeez.
Yeah, but it's center to center.
It is center to center, not how long it takes you to get there.
Yeah. So my long cross country will be Martin State to Millville to Cape May and back. So I'm looking forward to that. I tried to schedule it for Friday. And
you're getting down to the skinny there, man. You're just like, ain't got much left to work with, to learn, right?
So here's the deal. On a side note, I'm taking the written on Wednesday.
You're the second person I know taking it on Wednesday now. I have, my friend down here is taking it that day, too.
Nice. So I scheduled that a while ago. My instructor was like, look, pick a date. Set it up, you know, and that way you have a point where you have to take it.
Mm-hmm.
You have to be prepared by then. And I tell you what, it worked really well. I got the endorsement on Sunday. I'm ready. I've been getting pretty much 90s on all of them. So the only thing that's been killing me that I got to go over is VFR weather minimums. Not the weather minimums, the cloud clearances. For some reason, for the life of me, I cannot remember what they are for E and G. I don't know why. you know, the D, C, and B are easy because it's just 3 nautical miles and then 5, 1, 2. I just, for some reason, G and E, it's just, I can't get it. So I got to go over that. But every time I take a flight, my instructor's like, okay, here's what we have left. So after the last flight, like, okay, so we got to do an hour and a half left of simulated instrument time. We've got to finish up the night cross, the night work. I have to do 8 more takeoffs and landings at night. And I need, I believe, 0.7 hours. He's like, well, you need that too. We need to go over. We've gone over short field takeoffs and landings. We're just going to heavily do that for probably 2 lessons. So it's like, we'll do short field takeoffs and soft field takeoffs and landings. Go do your maneuvers. Turns around a point. S turns. We'll do those again. And then it's check ride prep.
Cool.
Wow.
And then I have to have my 7 hours of cross-country time. So I'm going to do this long cross-country, which will be about almost 3 hours. I'll try to see if I can make it 3 hours.
But you just soloed 2 episodes ago. Come on.
I know, right?
You're making this sound too easy for everyone thinking about becoming a pilot.
So this is the guy who didn't fly for how long?
Yeah.
And now he's ready for a check ride. You're killing us here.
So, it gets worse.
So long between flights, he forgot he couldn't even spell plane. Give me a break.
It gets worse too, because I got the long one, and then I'm going to do a couple shorter ones back to Cambridge to fill up my 10 hours of solo time. Because now we're counting hours, right?
Mark,
you know, we're going through my logbook and we're counting hours.
We're going to have to kick him out of the podcast because this is for student pilots.
Exactly. Yeah.
the scariest thing for me was. I got my solo endorsement on Sunday, and you know, we're going over stuff, and then he's like, okay, well, he's like, we get all this stuff done. He's like, I'm looking mid-January, maybe the 15th or 16th. I may call him up after the first. I may call up, I think his name's Mike, and schedule your check ride for the 15th or 16th.
Holy crap.
And I was just like, that's what I said.
Awesome.
Wow. I don't know how that's going to work.
3 weeks.
Wow.
Yeah.
Now, does your school do the stage checks?
Yes,
have you flown with another instructor?
I have, but I'm part 61, so technically I don't have to.
Well, I just figured maybe the school would have you fly with somebody else just so you're used to flying with a different – I mean, you've already experienced the different instructors. But at this point, go up with like the chief instructor, which is what I'm going to end up having to do, the chief instructor pilot, and then run through some stuff just to have a different person there.
He may do that. I'm actually not sure at this point. I'm not quite sure. The other thing, I'm not quite sure how we're going to fit everything into the next 3 weeks.
Well, when you're flying 10 hours a week, it's easy to do.
It's a kick.
Well, the problem is I was going to do my long cross country on Friday, but the plane is only available for 2 hours, which is not long enough for me to get there and back. Because I'm at least almost 3 hours just in the plane, not mentioning the pre-flight and all that kind of thing.
Sure.
So I'm actually in a little bit of an interesting thing here. Do I fly on New Year's Day?
It depends on what New Year's Eve is like for you.
Yeah. 8 hours.
Exactly. How important is that flight to you?
The airplane is available at 1 o'clock.
You might not be hungover by then.
I need to think about that, but I could be doing my long solo cross country then.
And it'd be a great way to bring in the new year.
Yeah.
I know.
I think that's more important than getting hammered the night before.
Yeah.
And then the other thing, too, is tomorrow night, he calls me today, and he's like, hey, so I have an idea. Instead of flying tomorrow morning, because it's supposed to be really windy, he's like, why don't we fly tomorrow night? We'll kill two birds with one stone. We'll get your instrument time and your night time done. He's like, why don't we go to Manassas? He's like, I'll file for an IFR, and he's like, I'll just let you fly the instruments. You know, because he's an IFR-rated pilot, so we can do an IFR flight plan, and I could just file, you know, get the instrument time or something.
That's cool he's willing to do that.
I believe is how we're going to do it. I could be wrong. It could just be I'm just going to – either way, I'm getting my simulated instrument.
In actual.
Well, not in actual.
Well, not actual IMC, but it'll be – yeah.
Possibly. I may have misunderstood him. But essentially, I'm getting my simulated instrument done tomorrow, and I'm getting my night flight done. So we'll do the 8 takeoffs and landings, and we'll get night and instrument done.
Awesome.
That's awesome.
So I'm going to have 7 hours of solo, short field, soft field, and maneuvers left.
What are you at total for hours now?
Let's see. I had 31 on that page. Let's see. 31 plus, what is that? 5, 36, 37, 38. I'm a little over 40.
So you're going to be in the mid-50s when you're done?
Probably.
Early to mid-50s, I'm guessing?
Yep.
Cool.
He said 45 minus the solo is probably when I'll be ready, I think. Or close to it.
Nice.
So I'm coming down to the end. Yeah. And it scares the crap out of me. I was nervous about the written for a little while. I'm not anymore. Now I focus my nervousness on the oral. Because I realized the other day that...
That's the real test.
That's coming up.
Because memorizing all those questions, anybody can do it after doing the practice exams for weeks and weeks at a time until you recognize the answer before even seeing the question, you know. And then with that dude's pounding you and he wants you to explain the reason why something is the way it is instead of it's C. The answer is C, you know. Now it's no longer C anymore. It's a specific reason, you know.
Exactly.
I experienced that firsthand with our chief instructor. Well, we talked about it on a previous episode, but that is enough to, if they start peeling the onion back, as I referred to it, mm-hmm. and you're like, I get flustered from there and I'm done. Done. Just come back, go read some more, come back tomorrow, you know?
My instructor has been the same way, just hammering me with questions every time. And half the time I'm stumped. I'm like, I used to know the answer to that. Or like, I honestly have no idea. I've never heard that question. And then it's like, you know, I mean, I get a lot of info out of it because then I get the answer, but it's just been question after question after question. And I will say the thing that's been helping me ease a little bit, the King School's oral check. They have videos on the full oral check ride, the oral and the check ride. And I recommend anybody buy it. It's worth it.
What was it again?
The King Schools has the practical, has videos uh-huh. on doing the practical, and they literally sit down and do an oral and a practical with a DPE.
Oh, that's cool.
And they go into a little more depth than maybe the oral will actually be, but it's great. It's just such a good thing to have and to kind of get like exposure to it. So you kind of know what to expect now. So it's making me feel a little better about it, but I'm still nervous as hell.
I have in my hands right here, the ASA Private Oral Exam by Michael D. Hayes, 8th edition. I'm trying to find out when it was published.
Actually, I may be getting one of those. It's about 2 years old too, from a friend.
8th edition was published in 2005, so I'm sure they've got about a 10th edition by now. But I'm just borrowing this from somebody, so I'm sure 98% of it's good enough.
it probably is. I mean, most of this new stuff, you realize it's new. Things like the medical, obviously those times have changed.
Yeah.
You know, most of it, you know the changes. So
does that about catch you up then, John?
Oh, I guess that does. Did I miss anything? I probably missed a lot.
You've done a lot.
I've done so much. And I've it's been amazing how quickly the cross-country stuff comes together. And then, you know, because you're solo and you're like, oh, I still have all this stuff to do. And then you do two flights and you realize, holy crap, I'm almost there. And I'm sure you guys are right on the edge of being close to experiencing this. I know, Mark, you're about to start the cross countries.
Yeah. I'm looking forward to it.
Yeah.
To quote a little Top Gun, I'm kind of in Top Gun mode. I got it all hooked up tonight, but, you know, now it's time to start that pilot shit.
Speaking of that, I don't know if you heard, but they're, in production for Top Gun 2.
I did hear that.
I
posted it on Twitter. Tom Cruise will have a part in it, but I don't know if it's more – I think it's more just a cameo. But if he was going to be in it, I expect him to be an instructor because that's what he was supposedly going to do after he graduated.
I heard a brief synopsis of what the story is supposed to be about. But, yeah, he's going to do a small part and he's going to – The battle, I guess, is between stick and rotor pilots and UAV pilots. Where UAVs, what it comes down to is that they want to phase out fighter pilots for drones.
Oh,
in the future, in the not too distant future, and there's a big battle between, you know, true fighter pilots and these guys are going to be drone pilots. So that's what the basis that I saw online was about.
Drones might be able to do a kick-ass job doing bombing runs or whatever, but air-to-air dogfighting, they wouldn't stand a chance, I wouldn't think.
I don't know. Higher Gs? They can handle a lot higher forces. I don't know. Yeah. It's a weird concept to even think about it. To have an Air Force or an Air Corps or, you know, the aviation branch that doesn't physically have somebody in the seat is kind of weird to me. But
I met one a few weeks ago.
A UAV driver?
Mm-hmm. He I met him at church a couple weeks ago. He
Was he a pimply? Was he a pimply faced kid with a joystick in his hand?
No, he's a retired F-16 pilot.
Wow!
And he does this in the Air National Guard now, down in Tucson. And so I ask him where he flies, and he goes, "I'm not really allowed to say," but you know. So he goes, "It's in one of the major theaters of war currently." That's all I could say. So he's flying UAVs that are in Afghanistan from Tucson, Arizona. And someone else takes them off. He takes it over while it's in the air. He hands it back off to someone else to land it.
That's what they do out of my neck of the woods, too.
There was a job opening for that. And once I had my pilot's license, I could have applied. And I believe is that your way, Chris?
Oh, yeah?
Yeah. I thought about it for a second. I was like, you need a computer science major and a pilot's license. I can do this.
Yeah. Piece of cake, piece of pie. You know how many hours I've logged in Microsoft Flight Simulator? Come on. Give me a break.
So you should know VORs really well by now.
Yeah, I've played around with them quite a bit on Flight Simulator. You know, it's one of the good things that things actually can be good to be used for is the instrument part of it, at least.
Definitely. And that's where I kind of learned and played with VORs the first time, too. And got fairly good at them and then kind of forgot them a little bit. But actually, the to and from is, mixed me up a little bit. I understood the concept of the radials and following it and all that kind of stuff. But the to from on the written test prep kind of got me a few times. But other than that, I got it down now.
That's exactly where I was, too. Once I started messing around with that the online VOR sim, I fired up Microsoft Flight Simulator. What was really cool, you get out there and you're doing your piloted stuff and you're trying to track radials. And I got myself I put the weather purposely in IMC like I was, you know, a knucklehead and I flew into the clouds and was like, okay, wait a minute, I got to start dialing the radials. What was cool about it was you just reach over and hit P when you get frustrated. It's like, wait a minute, pause. All right, now where am I? Oh, okay. I know where I'm at. And then you can continue on where if you're in, you know, real world and actual, you know, I wouldn't want to put myself in that position now because you kind of get frustrated and stressed out and that's not a good place to be when you're trying to find where you are in the clouds.
No added stress while you're in the air, please.
Yeah.
But a pause button would be really nice sometimes.
Oh, yeah.
Genius idea.
Especially on those first few cross countries when you're just overwhelmed with information.
Oh, hey, I was going to ask you, since you're so far into it, has your instructor started doing the trying to overload you? You know, it gets you, what do they call it, distractions? Has he started doing any of that kind of stuff yet?
Not that I'm aware of.
So one of the examples that I saw, he was like, you know, I'm going to kind of give you a heads up on this. And I remember it listening to Will Hawkins when he was going through his training. The instructor was, okay, we need to go here. Okay, now we're going to divert. And he has you recalculating everything. And he's talking at you and he's dropping a pen and he's doing all kinds of stuff. And you're like, okay, you need to stop. I got to concentrate for a second. And that's what he's looking for you to go take control of the cockpit and go stop. I got to do something. Let me figure this out. So I was just curious if you've had that yet.
So, okay. So he has dropped the pencil. And he made it look like a pretty good accident, but I'm fairly certain at this point. He dropped that on purpose. And I remember that now. I was like, damn it. I was like, why did you do that? I was like, I've already dropped it myself once. Why did you have to go do that? But he's done that. And actually, a family friend is a pilot as well, and he actually got his license out of the same airport I am. And he said the same thing. He said, watch out. He said, if it's Mike, I don't know what his name is, but if he's your DPE, he's going to be on final. He's just going to start, you know, BSing with you. Start talking about his family and all kinds of random stuff. And, you know, apparently he kind of does that to get you to say, look, sterile cockpit. You know, just shut the hell up. Let me land. Talk to me afterwards.
That's good.
Nothing wrong with that. Time and place.
You know, it's weird. It's weird though. I don't know if maybe it's my generation or the way I was raised or whatever, but you know, when there's somebody that's older than you, or it's a politeness thing, you listen to them, but it's at a point now, it's like, okay, wait, I'm pilot in command, you need to shut up. It's hard for me to tell somebody to shut up when they're talking to me, you know? It's like, okay, stop for a second. You know, if it's my kids or something, like, hang on, I got something I got to do real quick. But if it's somebody that's like an authority figure, it's a little tougher to do, especially being prior military. I could never imagine myself telling my CO, oh, stop, I got to do something real quick. You know, be like, you're going to jail, you know, kind of thing. So I was just curious, you know, how that would work, but.
Yeah, I'm a little nervous about having to say that just because I'm naturally, you know, kind of a quiet person to begin with in that kind of situation. You know, I for a while, you know, it was the instructor just told me what to do and I would just do it, you know, not thinking about it. And I'm getting to the point now realizing that I need to start taking control of things. But that part's kind of hard for me, just my personality wise. So it's going to be really hard with a DPE with a guy I've never met before.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. You know? I think you and I are in the same boat then in that respect.
Yeah. So I am a little worried about that.
If it's my instructor, I'd be like, all right, hang on, give me a second. Cause I'm comfortable with him, you know, or maybe one of the other instructors in the school, like I could be comfortable with, but somebody that I don't know, that's an authority, you know, they know more than I do. Obviously, if they're a DPE, maybe they're trying to tell me something I need to know, or are they really trying to mess with me? You know, I don't know. So we'll see. We'll see.
Yeah, I guess at this rate, I'll probably be telling you guys about the check ride.
By the next episode, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, no, it better not be. The thing is, I got a couple of booked weekends in the middle of January, so it may not be that early. My guess is closer to the end of January. Just saying.
Cool. We just need to get Chris flying more now.
Yeah.
Yeah, flying those 4 out of the 6 days, I ran through my money real fast.
Yeah. So much of that pile of money that was stacking up over there?
Yeah, but I found a new source, which I'll get into here in just a little bit.
So I'm going to have to go ahead and wrap up the episode 6 Alpha here. We have a lot more that we talked about. And that will be upcoming in episode 6, Bravo, which will be out as soon as I can get it edited in between studying for the oral exam and the check ride that, as of the editing of this episode, I have now scheduled. So it's going to be an interesting few weeks, but stay tuned for 6 Bravo.
The members of the In the Pattern podcast are participating as private individuals. Their comments do not necessarily reflect the views of the various organizations they work with, the instructors they learn from, or the flight schools they attend. Remember, these guys are student pilots, so anything you hear on this podcast that sounds like advice on an aircraft operation is obviously from the perspective of student pilot. You should always consider your own situation, consult your instructor, remember your training, and fly the airplane. Cleared for the option.
So that about wraps up 6 Alpha of the In the Pattern podcast. I'd like to thank y'all for listening. And remember, make left traffic, you're cleared for the option.
This and other great shows at the Aviation Podcast Network.
The Voices in Your Head.com.